Our show's name pays tribute to the Boer Trekkers of South Africa, who in 1838 soundly defeated 30,000 Zulus on the bank of the Nkomo River, thereafter called Blood River, from the water turning red with the blood of the slain. Miraculously, no Boer Trekker died and only three were wounded. Now, your friend, Eddie Miller, will be your ambassador for tonight's show.
Dear Blood River Radio family, I would like to thank you so much for hanging out. Thank you so much for putting up with me. I feel like I've been so high today, feeling so good, adrenaline so high. I feel like I've been inept and doing a crappy job, but I appreciate y'all people hanging on. I appreciate the excellent, excellent staff we've had on today. And it's not ending yet. It's not ending now. We got the Bitter Ender himself coming on. I'd like to thank you so much for supporting Blood River Radio. And I'd just like to say once again, the donor for this week were Jay-Z from Blood River Radio Zone, AZ. And a favorite for people who love me and Gene both, the Adams family sent me a box of candy from handmade up in Gatlinburg, and when they said there's some molasses candy in it, it reminded me and Gene both love that with molasses, man. Every time we see the Adams family, they always give us a quart of those good old dark sorghum molasses. But anyway, thank them very much for that. They sent a donation for Blood River. And, of course, Jay-Z from Blood River Radio Zone, AZ, he's like clockwork. People, we transition to third hour, we're getting ready to bring he's not going to be the general. Well, he still is the general, but we're on furlough for a couple of days. So during furlough, you don't get to rest with the Bitter Ender when he's the head of your cavalry unit you're riding in. You're going to have to go to school. You just don't sit around and lay around and nap. You have to go to school and learn stuff like Confederate history. So he's going to take care of that. But for about a minute or so, Will is going to continue. He didn't quite get to do his finish his presentation last hour, so the Bitter Ender said he doesn't mind, and Will could go ahead and do that. So anyway, I'm going to shut up. Will, go ahead and finish up what you're talking about this second hour, brother. Will, you there? I guess we lost Will. Well, anyway, Bitter Ender, I guess we lost Will some kind of way. So go ahead and continue on. Open up with the Confederate history, brother.
All right, I will do that. Now, I didn't cut him off the phone. That wasn't my doing right there.
You know what? I bet what happened. I bet when your wife clicked that thing that controls the mute button on you, she hit the wrong button.
Yeah. wrong number.
Yeah. She hit the wrong number, son. Oh, no.
Oh, well, I'm not surprised that might happen to me.
Well, you always put the mute button on me. So, but anyway,
no.
Well, I got to shut the hell up. Go ahead.
No, that's fine. That's fine. I want to ask permission from you as my commanding officer if we give a talk this week on one of our favorite generals, a fellow Tennessean, Nathan Bedford Forrest.
I ride under your command, son. You know that. You're the commander of this hour, son. You go ahead and do anything you want.
Well,
anything you want to do is fine.
What we like to do for our listeners is talk about Confederate history during the month that it happened. So being in the month of June, we would like to talk about a battle that General Forrest fought on the 10th of June in 1864 at a little spot in northern Mississippi called Bryce's Crossroads. And some historians have called this the perfect battle, because we're going to go through how he predicted early in the morning how that battle was going to be fought, and that was exactly how it turned out. And it was a total rout for the Federal Army, one of the worst defeats they ever suffered. And the interesting thing about this is, or what makes it so amazing, is Forrest had about half the men that the Federal Army had in numbers, and he had half of their artillery, and yet he still won such a complete victory that it was just absolutely amazing. And a lot of military historians and military schools around the world study this battle, and they call it the perfect battle, because it unfolded perfectly as he predicted it. So in June of 1864, Forrest was in northern Mississippi, and he was pulling his command together. In fact, they had already started and headed into Alabama, going into Middle Tennessee, and they were going to take out the Nashville and Decatur Railroad, which was Sherman's main supply line for his Atlanta campaign. And Forrest had stopped Grant, he had stopped Rosecrans, he had stopped Buell by simply riding around behind them and taking out their supply lines. And this was something else he was going to do. I mean, he could read a map as well as anybody. He knew Sherman in North Georgia was headed down the Western Atlantic Railroad and headed for Atlanta. So this is what he was getting ready to do. And they were already, his cavalry was already on the roads. They were headed across northern Alabama and headed for Middle Tennessee on June the 3rd. June the 6th, he received an order from his commanding officer in that part of Mississippi, Stephen D. Lee, and ordered him to come back to Tupelo, Mississippi. They knew that a large federal army was being sent out from Memphis to head into Mississippi. And Forrest had all of his men were scattered pretty much all over northern Mississippi because they didn't know exactly where Sturgis was going, and they had to check all the roads. And then after he crossed a certain point, they said, okay, he's not going to Corinth, or okay, he's not going to Holly Springs, or okay, he's not going here, there. They would fall back to where Forrest was pulling his command together. So anyway, this was one of the Yankee plans that they had, was to send out these armies from Memphis to attack Forrest in Mississippi and keep him bottled up in Mississippi. And they didn't care how many men they lost. They had an unlimited supply of men. And when they ran out from northern boys, they just brought them in from Ireland and Germany and all over Europe to restock their army for more people to send into the slaughter pen. So they didn't care. The only thing they wanted to do was keep Forrest occupied so he couldn't take out Sherman's supply line. And so that was the whole overall strategy, which actually worked because Forrest defeated all four of these armies that were sent after him, or he caused them to turn around and go back to Memphis. But by the time he got rid of all of them, it was September of 1864. He got into Tennessee and northern Alabama and tore out part of the railroad between Nashville and Decatur. But it was too late then. Sherman had already taken in Atlanta, and then he decided he wasn't going to fool with Forrest anymore. After Forrest then turned around, went back up into West Tennessee and destroyed the federal supply depot at Johnsonville on the Tennessee River, Sherman knew that he couldn't count on the federal government sending him supplies. So that's when he burned Atlanta and took off across Georgia and into South Carolina, just ignored his supply lines. So anyway, here was the situation. Forrest and his scouts knew that this large army had been sent out of Memphis, headed towards where they were. And here are some of the numbers. General Sturgis and his army had about 3,200 cavalry, about 4,500 infantry, and 22 pieces of artillery. Forrest, if he got everybody together that was scattered all over northern Mississippi, he would only have about 4,700 mounted soldiers and two batteries under Captain Morton and Captain Rice, or 12 pieces of artillery. So he was numbered in outnumbered 2-to-1 in manpower and outnumbered 2-to-1 in artillery, or just about. Now, an interesting point about this is the federal cavalry commander was General Benjamin Grierson. And that name may not ring a bell with a lot of our people, but he pulled off a raid in 1863 down through, left out of Tennessee, went down through the central part of Mississippi and all the way down into Baton Rouge. And he found out that there was really no major Confederate army in the central part of Mississippi. It was Pemberton over trying to defend Vicksburg, but he wasn't going to get any help from anywhere else. So it was a long raid, never really fought any battles. He was just riding through open countryside. And John Wayne used this raid for his Civil War movie. Everybody was making a Civil War back during the centennial of the Civil War, as they called it. And he made a movie about this guy. Grierson called it The Horse Soldiers. So I think that the Duke would have done a lot better to make a movie about the real horse soldier, Bedford Forrest, instead of this guy Grierson. And we're going to find out later on in our show what happened to Grierson when he met a real horse soldier at Price's Crossroads. So anyway, there's the situation. Forrest was sent back to Tupelo, and it started raining on the 8th of June 8th and 9th, it just poured. And then the sun broke early in the morning of the 10th. But like it is in northern Mississippi or Tennessee, when that sun comes out after all that rain, the air is so thick with humidity that you can almost see the air. It's that thick. And so that played a part in the battle. We'll get into that in just a minute. And Forrest was smart enough, He was a brilliant commander, and he never went to West Point or VMI, Citadel, any military school. He just had enough common sense and determination to know how to command under very trying situations on a battlefield. And you've been there, and you know how much pressure you're under and how panic-stricken people get and how things can fall apart in a hurry. And that was one of the characteristics of Forrest. He never lost his cool on the battlefield. If something happened that hadn't been planned, he would adjust to it. Where Braxton Bragg, the commander of the Army of Tennessee, if he didn't follow his plan, he just went into sort of a funk and couldn't do anything. So we're on the morning of the 10th of June, and we'll explain how the battle was fought when we get back.
Can't wait to hear that, Gene. Be right back, folks.
Introducing PrepStartsNow.com, your ultimate guide to readiness and peace of mind. We offer practical preparedness tools, training, and education to take your family's household readiness to the next level. Browse the prep shop for essential products, check out our planning guides, and stay informed with our prep blog. Visit PrepStartsNow.com and subscribe to our emails for exclusive offers, new products, and future events. Remember, preparedness begins with PrepStartsNow.com.
Okay, listen up, people. I'm beating the bushes for a few good men. I don't want you boys the alt-right. I want the hardcore of the hard-right. And I need you front and center, boots on the ground, at a minute's notice, in the streets, and I need your money. You know the problem that the whites of the world face. It's the all-too-real threat of global extermination. And you know what's going on in South Africa and Western Europe. And unless you're semi-comatose, you've already seen the first stages of white genocide unfolding in our country. Our culture is under constant full-scale attack by our enemy. The enemy never sleeps. They spend day and night wrecking the monuments and the graves of our beloved kin. They attack us physically everywhere we go. They've already taken the linen and our stone. Now they're coming after our flesh. And if you're not too squeamish, if you want to be part of the number one white advocacy group and the number one white civil defense group in the United States, then contact Eddie Bombardier Miller at BloodRiverRadio.com. And please, please donate. And God knows you need us as much as we need you. Thank you.
Former Sheriff Richard Mack recounts in his book, The Proper Role of Law Enforcement, how he came to realize while working as a beat cop how wrong the all-too-common orientation of police officers is when they think of their job as being to write tickets and arrest people. Richard Mack tells of his personal transformation from by-the-number cop to constitution-conscious defender of citizen safety and freedoms. Learn what it really means to serve and protect. Purchase your copy at CSPOA.org. That's CSPOA.org.
Tell you something, boy, if I did give you power, you've got nothing. Nobody gives you power. Real power is something you take.
Dear Blood Room Radio family, real power is something you have to take. Ain't nobody give you no power. But anyway, with that thought, we're going to go right back to the bitter ender and talk about Bryce's crossroads. And there ain't never been a genius in the United States in the military any better than Nathan Bedford Forrest. Go ahead, brother.
No, I think you're absolutely right there. And what studying I've done on military history, not just the War for Southern Independence, but military history all over the world, I don't think there's any commander in any time in history that did more than Forrest did with less men, numbers, equipment, support of the government, anything like that. He had the whole deck stacked against him and still had a brilliant military career. And had the Confederate government recognized early in the war his ability and what damage he could inflict on the enemy, if they turned him loose, there's no telling what the outcome of the war in the Western theater would have been, the Western theater being the battles that were fought west of the Appalachian Mountain chain. So they never recognized it. President Davis didn't, and the government in Richmond didn't, until it was too late and the war was over. And then Davis actually admitted he had made a mistake. He was misadvised, Bragg being one of them that hated Forrest, and he advised against anything that Forrest wanted to do. And he was more concerned with his reputation than he was winning our independence from the axis of evil Yankee Empire. So anyway, if he'd been given a free hand, there's no telling what Forrest could have done. And he always believed that the best strategy was to attack. Now, he was outnumbered over 2-1, And Forrest always attacked. He said, one man in motion is worth two standing to receive an attack. So that was his plan to stop this army moving out of Memphis. Stephen D. Lee wanted to fall back and draw them further away from Memphis, so if they got a victory, they would have a harder time getting back to the fortifications around Memphis. But Forrest, considering the weather and the location and where he had to pull all his men together, he picked this spot at Bryce's Crossroads because he knew that would be the best place to launch his attack. So that's exactly what they were going to do. And on that morning of June the 10th, just read something out of one of the books about Forrest, that Devil Forrest by Dr. Wise. It said, by the time it was light enough to see the roadway, the Confederate troops were in motion. Between 7 and 8 o'clock in the morning, while riding at the head of his column, Colonel Rucker said that General Forrest rode by his side. He told Rucker that he intended to attack the Federals at Bryce's. And then Forrest said, I know they greatly outnumber the troops I have in hand, but the road along which they will march is narrow and muddy. They will make slow progress. The country is densely wooded and the undergrowth so heavy that when we strike them, they will not know how few men we have. Their cavalry will move out ahead of the infantry and should reach the crossroads 3 hours in advance. We can whip their cavalry in that time. As soon as the fight opens, they will send back to have the infantry hurried up. Here's his quote. It's going to be hot as hell today, and coming on a run for 5 or 6 miles over such muddy roads, their infantry will be so tired out, we will ride right over them. And it said, I want everybody to move up as fast as possible. I'll go ahead with Colonel Lyon and the escort and open the fight. Now, that's Forrest. He knew that the weather was going to be brutal on the Federal soldiers with the wool jackets and the wool trousers. And his men were wearing pretty much the same thing. Wool wore a lot better back then than cotton did, lasted longer. But he expected the Federal soldiers to be worn out in that heat and muddy roads and the long distance they had to cover. But he expected his men to arrive on the battlefield and be ready to fight. And some of them had to travel 18 to 20 miles that day. Yeah, they were mounted, but still, that's a hard ride, even on horseback, to do that. So anyway, what he did was to attack the U.S. cavalry on both flanks before they could attack him. And like you said, in the heavy woods and the underbrush, they didn't know how many men were hitting him. And Forrest, at that time, had about 1,600 men on the field against Grierson's cavalry, which all of them were there. That was 3,200, so outnumbered 2-1. Confederate troops were arriving from Alabama. The horses were worn out, but they fought dismounted. Forrest ordered his men, outnumbered, to charge the enemy. And fighting was so close at times it was hand-to-hand. And this is a Confederate advantage that Forrest had studied about and prepared his men for. Forrest's men carried not only their rifle or shotgun, but they all carried at least 4 revolvers. And when you get into a close fight, a revolver is much better than a long rifle, because you had back then they were single-shot rifles, and so you fired one shot, and then all you were carrying then was a big, heavy club. But with those revolvers, you had 6 shots in each of them times 4. You had 24 shots right there. So the close fighting and attacking the flanks, the Federal cavalry had to keep pulling men out of the center of their line to reinforce the flanks because they were afraid the Confederates were going to cave in their flanks and get around behind them. By 12:30, Forrest had carried out his first part of his plan. He'd defeated the cavalry, and they were in retreat, falling back toward the crossroad. Just like he predicted, Grierson sent these desperate pleas to Sturgis, 6 miles away. We're greatly outnumbered. Bring up the infantry. By 1:30, reinforcements were coming in from far scattered units, and one of them that they really needed was John Morton's artillery along with Captain Rice's artillery battery. So an artillery battery had anywhere from 4 to 6 guns. Both of their batteries had 6 guns apiece. So they had 12 on the field versus 22. But that didn't bother Forrest at all. And they had tactics that were used that were studied in military schools today. What they did, and I've read where some historians call this the first tank battle, and people are going, wait a minute, Andrews, you got that all screwed up. Tanks didn't come along to World War I, 1914, but what they would do with their artillery, they would double load them with canister, and canister were these steel balls, and so it would basically turn a cannon into a giant shotgun and just massacre troops out in front of this when this thing was fired. They will double load these cannons with a canister and roll them up as close as they could to the federal lines and fire these things at one battery at a time, six guns at a time, blast a hole right through the federal lines, and then the dismounted cavalry soldiers would come in behind them. And basically, that's what a tank is. It's just an artillery piece mounted on tracks, and it clanks along and blasts a hole in the enemy lines, and then the infantry comes through behind them. Well, Forrest was a century ahead of time, or half a century ahead of time, and using his artillery as tanks on this battlefield to overcome the numbers that he didn't have. So Forrest attacked 8,000, over 8,000 U.S. soldiers with only 3,300. Just like he predicted, they sent back desperate messages to the infantry to come up and save the cavalry. They're being driven off the field. And I read in the account of General Sturgis after the battle, and he was explaining why he got defeated so badly. And he estimated that the Confederates had between 15 and 20,000 troops on the field, which in fact they had a little over 3,000. It's just Forrest tactics, and he couldn't comprehend what was going on there. So about 4 p.m., the infantry finally made it to the crossroads and said, just like Forrest predicted, they were worn out. A lot of the guys during that hard march up from where they were the night before to Bryce's Crossroads through that mud and that heat, and we've all been out there in the heat,
yeah,
in
boy.
Tennessee and Mississippi in the summertime, and that humidity after a heavy 2 days of heavy rain, like we said, you could almost see the air, it's so thick. A lot of the guys just fell out from heat exhaustion. Some of them died from heat stroke. So by the time they got to where the battle was going on, most of them just dropped down on the ground trying to catch their breath, and some of them were so weak they couldn't even stand up and load a rifle. So Forrest's prediction, as he said early that morning, it came true. By the time the infantry got there, they were worn out. They really weren't a factor in the battle by that time. So they actually had a charge with their artillery. The Confederate gunners would get one on each wheel, and two of them would lift up the trail and load this cannon up and push it forward. So they actually had an attack with cannons, if you can believe that. It wasn't just dismounted cavalry infantry. They were using their cannons, like we said, like tanks, to just roll them forward and blast holes in the enemy lines. And during the day, the Confederate artillerymen pushed those cannons over 3 miles in that heat and humidity. Now, not all at one time. It'd be 50 yards, 100 yards, something like that. But the total distance from the time they unlimbered from the limbers and wheeled the guns around and started moving them forward, and from then on it was manpower, it wasn't horsepower. They pushed them and drug them and whatever else you want to do to it over 3 miles that day. The artillery fire was so devastating to the federal lines that their defensive lines began to collapse around the Bryce House at the crossroads. The Confederates then kept pushing forward and captured two of their pieces of artillery and turned their artillery around and loaded it and started firing on them. General Sturgis then ordered the United States Colored Troop Brigade, black troops, who were held out of the battle and guarding the wagon train. There were 250 wagons that were carrying their supplies and their ammunition, and a lot of them were empty when they left Memphis because they were going across northern Mississippi and stealing whatever they could from the people in northern Mississippi, taking whatever food they had or forage for their animals that they were trying to use to make a living, and any kind of valuables that they had in the homes, they were just loading those up and taking that. They thought that was easy pickings. And then they'd haul all that back to Memphis and take it back north with them. So anyway, the battle is going as far as predicted, and we'll tell you how it wound up here as soon as we get back from the break.
Gee, they never read that book, How to Win Friends and Influence Enemies.
No, they didn't.
Be right back, folks. Maybe Gene can tell us all about that book. Be right back, folks.
How would you like to help this program reach more people and earn silver at the same time? Call or text 801-669-2211 for complete details.
News this hour from Town Hall, I'm Mary Rose. The U.S. has intercepted Iranian missiles and drones fired at Gulf allies Bahrain and Kuwait.
Air raid sirens in Bahrain as Iranian missiles and drones head for Gulf neighbors, including Kuwait. Bahrain's government says those missiles were intercepted and called on Iran to immediately cease attacks on its Gulf neighbors. The statement came hours after the U.S. military said it shot down Iranian ballistic missiles and drones launched toward the Strait of Hormuz and Gulf Arab allies on Friday, and struck some of the Islamic Republic's coastal surveillance radar sites in response. I'm Julie Walker.
Six more states held primary elections this week, and the top Republican in Congress is concerned about many of the results. On the Salem News program this week on Capitol Hill with Tony Perkins, House Speaker Mike Johnson says the Democrats seem intent on nominating far-left radicals for the House and Senate.
The farther and farther left candidates are making their way through these primaries, and some of them are prevailing, heading down into runoffs. Really dangerous people with really dangerous ideologies. They're Marxists, and they want to turn America into that. So we have to defeat them. This is a battle of ideologies. We say it often, the widening chasm between the two parties. It's, you know, in terms of our philosophy, has never been as great as it is. And that's where the stakes are so high.
The Chicago Bears may be moving their stadium out of Illinois.
The decision came down after a proposal for tax breaks and financial incentives stalled in the Illinois legislature. The Bears Board of Directors voted to move forward with a project in Hammond, Indiana. That's about 22 miles south of the current facility. Local state representative Cam Buckner said he'd been talking to Bears CEO Kevin Warren and suggested that Illinois might still be on the table. The Bears have played in Chicago since 1921 and Soldier Field since 1971. I'm Jennifer King.
More on these stories at townhall.com.
Larry Elder here. You know, I think a lot of people just accept pain. Like, this is just how it is now. I don't think that has to be true. Let me tell you about George. He's up in Oregon. Works 10-hour days driving a garbage truck in and out all day. It really did a number on his knee. He said it got so bad, he couldn't even bend it. Now think about that. Trying to work, take care of your family, and your body just isn't cooperating. Well, George tried Relief Factor, and this is what got me. He said, I can bend my knee again with very little pain. Simple, but when you get something like that back, it matters. My brother Kirk had difficulty going up and down the stairs in the morning until he followed my advice. After about a week, he calls and said, this stuff is working. If you're dealing with aches and pains, see if Relief Factor works for you. It's drug-free with a three-week quick start for just $19.95. Go to ReliefFactor.com. That's ReliefFactor.com or call 800-4-RELIEF, 800-4-RELIEF. You don't have to just accept living with pain.
Blood River Radio is the only news media in the United States whose sole purpose of being is to fight against the ever-rising tide of global white genocide, both soft and hard genocide, whether it is in the form of ethnic cleansing via the current massive invasion of non-white, non-Christian hordes that are overwhelming the once all-white nations of Western Europe, the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the United States, or via the hard genocide in South Africa, where the rape, murder, and torture of whites is an ongoing daily occurrence. Though we are a Christian brotherhood, we will cooperate with other groups in our operations if it will shorten our people's casualty list. We further pledge to you to leave the radio studio at every opportunity and take it to our churches, to our universities, and most importantly, we promise to occupy the streets. However, none of our mission can succeed without funding. Please help us all that you can and donate to our cause by going to www.bloodriverradio.com.
Are you watching what's happening in our country and asking, what can I do? Join the John Birch Society in Salt Lake City, June 6th, for a powerful one-day conference. The day includes a host of respected speakers, two meals, and meaningful connections. You'll gain clarity on the issues and walk away with practical steps you can take to your community. Reserve your seat today at jbs.org/SLC26. That's jbs.org/SLC26.
In the medical field, IT security is crucial. Our highly skilled consultants are HIPAA certified and have 20 plus years of experience servicing medical clinics, billing and supply companies. We offer comprehensive endpoint protection, guarding your computers and servers against all stages of threats. And with our 24/7 monitoring services, you'll never worry about extensive downtime again. Ready to level up your IT support? Call 801-706-6980 today and discover how great IT services can be with Managed IT Services.
Come in the morning. Smells like victory.
Some folks are born made to wave the flag.
Dear Blood River Radio family, I don't want to get the bitter end or off track too much, but we were talking about how horrible the Yankees did to the South during that war, during Lincoln's War. But I meant to ask, I'll ask him now. Bitterinder was talking about how the Yankees have no respect whatsoever for the churches. He told me a story about how the Yankees poured some molasses down the church organs. I was going to ask, Shallow, Gene, was the at the Battle of Shallow, wasn't there a church there?
That's where it got the name. The battle was actually fought at Pittsburgh's Landing. That's where Grant had landed his troops. They'd come down river after they'd captured Fort Henry and Fort Donelson. They were coming down the river to go into northern Alabama or disembark at Pittsburgh Landing and then march down to Corinth. And they wanted Corinth, Mississippi, because it was a big rail junction. If they captured that, that messed up the Memphis and railroads running to the east or heading south into further down into Mississippi. So, yeah, and even during the war, they called it the Battle of Pittsburgh Landing because that was the main topographical point that they were both fighting over, was to get control of that steamboat landing there. So it wasn't until later on until they kind of came up with the name of Shiloh for the church that was there.
I got close in. Okay. But I hope I didn't throw you off. But
No, that's fine. That's fine. No, I think we need to keep our listeners informed. And I've had people, we were talking about this during the break, people ask me, why do you Southerners keep fighting the war? Because the war was fought in Tennessee and Alabama and Virginia. It wasn't fought in Michigan and Illinois and Pennsylvania and Maine. When I was a kid, I didn't know it at the time, but I used to ride my bicycle back and forth over parts of the Nashville battlefield. And then when I got Stanley Horn's book, The Decisive Battle of Nashville, and started reading that, I'm going, holy cow, I know exactly where that is. I used to ride my bicycle over there on Battery Lane and Granny White Pike and all of those places, Leland Lane, where the Battle of Nashville was fought. And I didn't know that till I read the book about that. So anyway, it makes a difference when the war is fought right in your front yard.
Oh, yeah.
And when you have an enemy that has total disregard for compassion for an unarmed civilian population and fights against the civilians and acts like they're just the greatest bullies in the world to fight against an unarmed civilian population, doesn't speak very well for the conduct of the soldier or the government that allows that to happen. And you can throw that back on Lincoln. And they say, well, Lincoln didn't do that. No, but he allowed his troops and he encouraged his troops to do that. So, it wasn't the fact that Lincoln was out there stealing property from the Southerners and using we were talking about they used the churches for stables for the horses for the Yankee army. And they would even rip up the pews and take them out of the churches, put them out in the churchyard, and use the pews for feed troughs to feed the horses. And, having horses in a church, and we all know that horses leave stuff behind in the stalls.
Yes.
Has to be mucked out. I'm sure they left it on the floor of the churches as well. That's how insulting is that, to have your horses stabled in a church? But that's what they did. You know, it's like we can do anything we want to, that we'll just come in and destroy your homes, we'll destroy your churches. And we were talking about how they would shoot a kid's dog or their pony or something.
Yeah.
And then take the carcass and dump it down a well. And then you've got that polluted water in a well. You can't drink it because you're going to get cholera from that, from drinking polluted water. And they would even take the salt in these big salt boxes where people had salted down the hams and shoulders and sausage and everything, bacon, from the hogs when they kill hogs in the wintertime. They'd take that salt and scatter it on the fields so you couldn't grow anything there. So by the end of the war, the South was just starving, on starvation rations, the Army and the civilians. And that's why it took the South over 100 years to actually recover from what the Yankee Army had done to us in 4 years of warfare and then 12 years of Reconstruction, which in a lot of places is even worse than the war. Because after the Confederate Army surrendered, there was no military force left to defend the people. And the Yankee government brought the horrors of the Yankee government to parts of states that had never been affected by the war, unless you had a son or a husband or somebody that was actually in the Army. In certain corners of Arkansas or Mississippi or southern Georgia or places like that, you never knew the war was going on unless you had a family member that was involved in it. But Reconstruction, they were stealing everything they could get their hands on. It went to every county in every state in the South. And that's one of the reasons why they founded these secret organizations to defend themselves, like the Red Shirts in South Carolina and Texas and Louisiana. It was the Knights of the White Camellia. And in southern Middle Tennessee and northern Alabama, it was the Ku Klux Klan. And that was the only protection they had. And people whine and yap today about how terrible the Klan was. Well, another book by Stanley Horne, The Invisible Empire, in the introduction, he said, bad government makes for bad citizens. And if you had a rotten and corrupt government that was stealing everything and encouraging the blacks to go out and attack the whites, especially the white women in the South, you're going to resist that. No real man's going to stand around and watch his family be attacked.
Amen to that.
Whether it's a military or a corrupt government or whoever. So anyway, got off track a little bit on that, but I think people need to know why the South was so resistant to the federal government after the war and the Republican Party. The Republican Party back then was the nutcase party. They would have had AOC and Chuck E. Schumer and Gavin Newsom and all these wackos that are in the Democrat Party today. They would have been big-time Republicans back then. And that's why the Republican Party was so hated in the South after the war. And I can remember that as a little boy. If an election for governor, Senate, anything in Tennessee, the only election that counted was the Democratic primary, because the Republicans could not get enough signatures to get somebody on the ballot. Forget about the votes. They couldn't even get the minimum amount of signatures to get somebody on the ballot, except sometimes East Tennessee, we'd have a representative in the U.S. House from East Tennessee that was a Republican. And, of course, that's all changed now. The Republicans are more conservative. I wouldn't call them the conservative party, but more conservative than the Democrats. And the Democrats have all the crazy wackos today. But back in the 1850s, 60s, and 70s, it was the Republicans that had all the nutcases in their party. So anyway, that's where we came from. So we were talking about the tactics that Forrest's men used at this battle to turn the tide of battle. And they were using their artillery basically like we talked about tanks. They were rolling the cannons forward, double loading them with canister, those steel balls, and just blasting holes in what was left of the Federal lines. And then the Federal lines began to break and fall back. The General Sturgis called on his troops that were guarding their wagon trains. It was the USCT, United States Colored Troops, their brigade to be brought forward. And they came under artillery fire, and they began to retreat just like the white troops had, except the black troops were real busy ripping these pieces of paper off their uniforms. When they were organized in Memphis, they were pulling all these black troops together to send them into Mississippi after Forrest and get revenge for Fort Pillow, which was in April of 64. And that was the big Yankee propaganda myth that they said that the Confederates had ordered a massacre of all the black troops at Fort Pillow and yada, yada, yada. Well, they took out over 200 prisoners. There were another 130 that were too seriously wounded to be moved, and they left them behind. So as far as they ordered a massacre at Fort Pillow, they didn't do a very good job of it. They had a lot of them left over. So anyway, they had all these pieces of paper pinned on their uniforms that said, "Avenge Fort Pillow, no quarter for Forrest's men." Now, when Forrest's men started pouring over this hill and the artillery was blasting the living daylights out of them, you should have seen how fast they were pulling those pieces of paper off of them. And they were cutting the traces of the horses that were hooked to the wagons or the artillery, cutting those traces and jumping on the horses and using them to get out of there, because, you know, four legs can run a lot faster than two.
Yes.
And they were in a big hurry to get the heck out of there. And what began as a very orderly retreat turned into a rout. They were in such a hurry, they had a wagon overturn on this bridge over Tishomingo Creek, and that was back behind Bryce's Crossroads. And they left most of the wagons, and they were one of them, they were trying to get away, and this wagon overturned, so now the bridge was blocked. And I've been down there to that battlefield and stood in that creek. Well, during the summer when it's not up at flood stage, the banks of the creek were up higher than my head. And just standing down in where the bottom of it was, it's a little stream, you know, not 6 feet wide, 6 feet wide. But we had those 2 days of rain, and the creek was running at flood stage. So now they were in a panic. The bridge was blocked. They couldn't get across it, just a few at a time climbing over that wagon. So a lot of them jumped in the creek and either drowned or they were shot when they were trying to swim away and get across that creek. So organized retreat turned into a panic to try to get out of there. And we see how the whole thing just kind of fell apart right there. So we'll finish up what happened and the retreat from Bryce's Crossroads after we get back from our break.
Can't wait to hear that, Gene. Be right back, folks.
Bypass the mainstream narrative with Liberty News Radio at libertynewsradio.com. Engage with charismatic hosts live or on demand. We cover the crucial news focused on God, family, and country. News that other networks simply refuse to use. Think of LNR's hard-hitting news and podcasts at your fingertips anytime, anywhere. Join us at libertynewsradio.com. Empower your day with the truth, because the truth will set you free. libertynewsradio.com.
Hello, friends. This is Jacob from Blood River Radio. We call the kings into account and tell the truth to shame the devil on this show every week because we are of the firm conviction that our cause cannot succeed without true revival amongst the remnant, amongst that principled minority of the dispossessed majority. Now is the time to stand and be counted, to do like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who would not bow down to the false idols of their day, even under pain of death, like the 300 mighty men of valor who surrounded the Midianites with Gideon, or the 7,000 men that God told the prophet Elijah had not bowed their knees to Baal in a time when even calling fire down from heaven would not awaken our kinsmen from their slumber. If you are encouraged by our labors in the trenches for the kingdom and the cause of truth, liberty, and righteousness, I urge you to consider supporting this program. No donation is too small. We can do with thousands or even hundreds what our enemies and the powers and the principalities of this present darkness need tens of millions to do. So please donate today at BloodRiverRadio.com and help us take up the hedge and stand in the gap against the great evils of our time.
Are you ready to stand up for your community and support your local sheriff? Join the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association and become a vital member of the Sheriff's Citizens Posse. At CSPOA.org, we empower citizens like you through weekly webinars, arming you with the knowledge to back your constitutional county sheriff. Together, we can uphold our Constitution and ensure liberty and justice for all. Your community needs you now more than ever.
Hello, Blood River Radio family. Hey, yo, me and Gene were talking about something very interesting in the break. Gene's going to let you know something you can do if you have a day or two off.
Talking about the topography around there and how smart Forrest was to figure out how to use the topography and the climate, the weather that day, and where the enemy was spread out. He factored in all those things. It's like he had a computer in his head. He was operating on AI back before it ever came along, and figured out all the advantages he could use to defeat an enemy that was twice his size. And we were talking about Bryce's Crossroads and that Tishomingo Creek there. And if anybody's in the Memphis area or West Tennessee, southern part of Tennessee and the western third of Tennessee, I would really encourage our listeners to go down there to Bryce's Crossroads. It's not that far across the Mississippi state line. And just to see what that terrain looks like. And I would advise going on the hottest day you can pick in the summertime, so you will see exactly what the soldiers were going through on both sides. And, of course, the roads are all paved now. You don't have to struggle along through a muddy, narrow road. And but the area around there looks pretty much like it did in June of 1864. It hadn't been cleared out, and housing developments with all the Yankee carpetbaggers moving in, or McDonald's or Walmarts or anything like that. It's still basically small farms and heavily wooded area on either side of the road. So if you go there, you're going to see exactly what Forrest was talking about how the underbrush and the woods are so heavy, they won't know how few of us they are, and then see where they had to come running up this road to get to the battlefield, and the heat and humidity of that day did as much damage to the Federal Army as the Confederates did. So anyway, with all that put together, the tide had turned for Forrest Cavalry. They were Forrest using the tactics that he used all the time. He attacked both flanks of the enemy and threw enough soldiers into a frontal assault just to keep them pinned down and think they were under pressure and think the main attack was coming from the front. And then all of a sudden, he had both of these attacks coming from the left and right flank. And he even got some of his men around behind the Federal lines, and they were attacking him from the rear. So they decided, that's enough. We've had it. We're leaving. And so what began as an orderly retreat turned into a rout. We were talking about that wagon turning over on the bridge. And the USCTs had all the paper pinned on them, that no avenge Fort Pillow, no quarter for Forrest's men. And, boy, they were pulling that off and throwing it away. Oh, that Eddie put that on me. I didn't do that. That Eddie put that piece of paper on me. Getting out of there as fast as they could. So anyway, and we were talking about, I've been there to that battlefield and been down in the creek bed there at Tishomingo Creek, but it hadn't been after 2 days of rain. It was hot in the summertime, and the creek was down, you know, in the very bottom of the creek bank there, and only about 5 or 6 feet wide. But with 2 days of rain, the water was up to the top of the bank, and the top of the banks were taller than my head, and I'm over 6 feet tall. So, you know, they had at least 6 feet, maybe 7 feet of water in that creek. So trying to get across there wasn't an easy job to do, and that's where a lot of the Federal soldiers in a panic jumped in there, because the bridge was blocked with that overturned wagon. Only a few people could climb over that at a time. So they just jumped in the creek, and they either drowned, or the Confederates that were closing in on them shot them there in the creek. They were easy targets there. So anyway, another some of Forrest's tactics to stay after the Federals and keep them moving and wear them out and just pick up prisoners. It was amazing what they got. The Confederate losses were 493 killed and wounded. The U.S. losses were over 2,600.
Dang.
They lost all 250 of their wagons, and they lost 20 of their 22 pieces of artillery. And they were in such a hurry to get away from the battlefield, they just threw their weapons away. The Confederates picked up over 5,000 weapons, rifles, pistols, and so forth, that were just thrown away. And they got over 500,000 rounds of ammunition. So it was a pretty complete victory. Now, here's another thing that Forrest did. Right at the end of the battle, he ordered his horse holders. These, in the cavalry, what they would do back then, every fourth man was designated as a horse holder. So you would take the reins of your horses and your horse and three other horses and get them out of the way, because if the horses got shot or killed, then sorry, you're back being with the infantry. And in the Confederate Army, every man had to furnish his own horse, so you had to take care of them. So these horse holders, and they were usually, the horse holders were young boys or old men that they didn't want to put right up in the front lines, but they could at least hold horses. And the way they did it, they would have a ring through part of the bit, and they just run the reins through that of all four horses. So you could just get a handful of reins and pull all four of them to go wherever you wanted them to, down in a ravine or behind a hill or something to keep the horses safe. So Forrest told the horse holders, just tie them off on a tree and jump into this attack. And they attacked Sturgis's men on this retreat the rest of that day while it was still daylight and on into the night. And then what he did, the ones that had opened the battle early in the morning, he gave them a chance to rest and just drop down and sleep right on the road or the ground, wherever they were, and got them up at 1 a.m. on June the 11th and put them back into the attack, and then took the horse holders out, gave them a chance to rest. So that pursuit went on all night. They didn't let up. As Forrest was like a bulldog. Once he got them beaten, he stayed on them. And one of the greatest quotes of the war, well, that's what Forrest did. We go back till 1863 when he was in pursuit of Colonel Strait and his raiders that were coming across northern Alabama. That's how he did. He split his men in half. Half of them would attack the Yankees and make them keep falling back and try to take different defensive positions, and half of them could sleep or rest, and same thing for the horses. Then after a few hours rest, they would swap and let the rested soldiers carry on the attack, and the ones that had been fighting for 10 or 12 hours give them a break. So Strait's men never got a chance to rest because Forrest is always throwing fresh troops in there against them and keeping them moving. So it did pretty much the same thing against Sturgis and his men after this retreat from Bryce's Crossroads. And that night, Sturgis had a panic meeting with his officers and wanted him to make a stand somewhere. Retreat back to Ripley, it took them 2 days to get there. Go all the way back to Memphis. It took them 2 weeks from Memphis to get to Bryce's Crossroads. It only took them 2 days to get back. They were in a lot bigger hurry to get back than they were to come out of Memphis. Yeah, and Forrest was staying after him. So Sturgis had a meeting with his officers, and they urged him to make a stand. We need to make a stand. And Sturgis came up with one of the best quotes of the war. He said, if Mr. Forrest will just leave me alone, I will leave him alone. But Forrest wasn't about to leave him alone. And, of course, Forrest led from the front. He believed that, you know, he ought to be doing everything his enlisted men do. He wasn't going to order some enlisted man to do something that he wouldn't do. And that's why they had so much respect for him. So he was riding up the road there and making sure they kept this pursuit going and didn't give the federal soldiers any chance to stop and rest. And they were picking up prisoners and wagons and artillery pieces all along this retreat. And he got so tired, he went to sleep in the saddle. And his horse went to sleep. And the horse was just kind of plodding along with his head drooping way down. And Forrest was asleep in the saddle. And so some of his staff officers saw this, and they said, they were going like, Eddie, you better go over there and wake him up. Eddie's going, heck no, I'm not going to wake him up. You go over there and wake him up. They didn't want to get chewed out for anything. And the horse kind of stumbled off the road and walked into a tree and kind of bolted his head up and woke up Forrest. He pulled the reins over and got the horse back on the road, and they continued their pursuit after that. So anyway, that ought to give our listeners a little bit of an idea of what happened in what was referred to in military terminology as the perfect battle. And another story that goes along with that, I've heard several people and even read some accounts of this, that during the 1930s, there were two German officers that came over to northern Mississippi and studied this battle. And one of them was Erwin Rommel, you know, the Desert Fox.
Oh, yes.
And the other one was Hans Guderian, who was the father of the modern Blitzkrieg.
Yes.
Because he figured out how many tanks you needed in a battalion, how many trucks you needed to carry fuel and ammunition and other track vehicles you need to go to use to keep up with the tanks. And they came and studied this battle. And it's not really heavily reported, but I've had several people tell me they've read accounts from an elderly woman that was living in northern Mississippi at the time and said, oh, yes, there were two German officers that came here. And she didn't know who they were. But, you know, being Southerners, they offered them something cold to drink and come in and have supper with us or whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
And, that they were there and studied that. And you look at a lot of Rommel's tactics when they went through the Ardennes Forest and just cut the British and the French armies all to pieces. It looks a lot like Forrest tactics. So maybe they were studying Forrest tactics and what they do with their panzer corps or panzer divisions in the German army that they had. They didn't mind getting tactics from an American, even a terrible Southern American that, you know, that's trash today. They went to the best source they could get to study what military tactics should be. So I hope that'll help out our listeners a little bit in June. The battle is fought on the 10th of June, 1864. Thank you, Eddie. Appreciate your time.
Well, thank you. And people need to go over there to Bryce's Crossroads. I guess that's Tishomingo County over there. I guess that would be east of Corinth. But anyway, people, I hope you enjoyed the program. I'm sure you did. And, God willing, we'll see you same time, same place next week. Good night, everybody. Good night, Miss Lee. Good night, Jane. Good night, Blood Radio family.
Okay.